This is NegotiateX Podcast, show number 87, part B.
You're listening to NegotiateX Radio, helping you elevate your influence through purposeful negotiations. If you're here looking to learn about how to become a better negotiator in both business and life, then you're in the right place. Stay tuned and be sure to join the others who have benefited from NegotiateX.com, your home for negotiations training and consulting online.
Hey everyone, thanks for joining us on the NegotiateX Podcast. We are continuing our conversation with Guy Ellis, a tenured executive leader, M&A expert, and serial entrepreneur. If you haven't already checked out part A of this show, be sure to do that first. Let's jump in the conversation with Guy.
So relationships are built and sometimes they last a lifetime, right? Yeah. And just like if you do a mountain bike marathon and it's a team race, right? Very often it is. The relationships that you build with your teammate over those 3 or 5 days or whatever the case may be in a stage race, they last a lifetime. I mean, it was a really good friend of mine that I actually did a stage race with in 2015. Yeah, in South Africa. And it was his birthday beginning of February. And I called him and we spoke for like an hour and a half, right? And it felt like we just spoke last week. And I haven't spoken to him in like a year, right? Probably since his birthday last year or my birthday last year. So it's these relationships that are built and they really do last a lifetime. So I think I mentioned it earlier, right? I've had people who would only sell their business to me personally, right? And that alone does not happen overnight, right? These things are built over time. And I think a few key points and for listeners to take away is that authenticity, kindness, care, but then also on the other side, grit, skill, perseverance. These are all key elements in sports and in negotiations. And I don't think people think about that when they think about negotiations. When they think about sports and mountain biking marathons, it maybe does come to mind, but especially in a team event. But in negotiations, people don't really think about those things.
Right.
So I have to ask out of complete ignorance, because I've never been to Africa yet. When you do these mountain bike marathons, are they through like safaris and in places where lions could possibly be chasing you or anything like that?
It's a great question. So most are not, right? But you do get some that are, right? And they're spectacular. Like, it's not what you think, right? You think, oh my word, I'm going to be riding my bike and there's going to be lions chasing me. And it's really not like that. And if you are worried about animals, it's buffalo and elephant and things like that and hippos and not really lions. So
I'm sure there's a metaphor in there somewhere for negotiation as well. There's probably many negotiations where you feel like you're being chased down by a lion or pressured by other external or internal factors.
Yeah. Harim, I love that you bring that up because I felt like I've negotiated with a lot of elephants and lions in my history. I mean, it's happened, right? And you do walking safaris and you bump into elephants. And I joke with my sister that I nearly killed my brother-in-law a week before their wedding, right? Because I took him to Botswana on the safari and we decided to drive to one of the outlying islands. And this breeding herd of elephants, right? So like a matriarch and her sisters and their like offspring were, just feeding. And we kind of drove too close to them. We were still very far, probably about 150 yards away, but we drove too close to them and our vehicle got stuck in mud and we couldn't get out. And then when we started revving the engine and spinning the wheels to get out, we kind of got bogged down and it was just a total disaster. And we got charged by them and it was crazy. But how we got saved was a huge male bull elephant just decided to like, he was in heat and he decided to like walk into this island just at the perfect time. And they were more scared of him than us. And he pushed them away and we managed to get the vehicle out and all was good. But it was a good story to take away.
I love the wildlife discussion. I mean, a couple guests ago, we were talking about swimming with sharks. Now we're wrestling with wild animals too. So you never know what's going to show up.
Yeah, totally.
So continuing on this theme here, would love to kind of dig into your wildlife conservation nonprofit work Have you faced any unique negotiation challenges within the nonprofit sector? And if so, would you mind sharing what challenges you faced and how you did or are working on to overcome them?
Sure. So also a great question, Nolan. So there's so many, right, in the nonprofit sector, especially in Africa. So I'd say the biggest challenge is aligning the goals of the various stakeholders. And there's a lot of them, right? So communities, recipients of funding, scientists, donors themselves, volunteers, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it gets very complex because you've got to understand all of their needs, right? And their needs are totally different, right? And not only do you need to understand their needs, but you've got to tie them all together, right? So that is a huge task just in itself, right? Beyond just understanding their needs. And again, this is all about relationships that are built over time before you get to that point in time. So I think the biggest ways to overcome these challenges are like transparent communication is key, right? Like if you don't, you know, communicate quickly and transparently, that's an issue and you start losing trust and people start talking and you want to avoid that at all costs. And then also education and awareness, right, is huge. You know, on all sides, some people think that, oh, it's just on the recipients of the funding, but it's actually very often on the scientist side and on the donor side that you have to educate and you know, create awareness around certain nuances around nonprofits and things like that. And then the whole thing is basically a big partnership and it's based on trust and you've got to be flexible. But you have to be cognizant of the fact that these are people usually based in all different places around the world. And again, going back to our earlier discussion about culture, totally different upbringings, cultures, socioeconomic backgrounds, et cetera, et cetera. And juggling all of that is a mammoth task.
Yeah, I think we underestimate when we talk partnerships, just how difficult. And it's interesting you're talking about from a nonprofit perspective, and certainly as you think about corporate M&A work too, but how difficult partnerships can be. I mean, I think the research, and you can probably correct me where I'm wrong here, Guy, but the research, I mean, over 50% of partnerships, M&As, joint ventures end in some sort of failure. They never live up. They don't capture the value we thought when we negotiated and thought and planned them. And I'm just, you know, so you've talked about the need for transparent communication, building trust. I mean, what do you see as kind of being the leading causes for these failures and the fact that, yeah, it really is hard to kind of create the dynamics, whether it's in a nonprofit world or a corporate world, to be successful?
Totally, totally. So, Aram, I'd love to get your take on that. But my thinking is that people are going into these M&A transactions, as an example, thinking about what I can get out for myself. Right. And partners go in and they're like, well, what can I get out for myself? And they're not actually going in and saying, what do my partners need? What do they want? What are their desires? What are their ambitions? And same thing for an M&A transaction. What are your expectations of this deal? Right. How are we going to integrate? Like people are worrying about closing the deal and not worrying about what would the other side like an integration to look like? What would make them happy from an integration perspective? Right. And very often it's none of the stuff that you would even think about or include in a contract to close the deal, right? And
yeah,
I think that's the biggest thing is, and I'd love to get your take, but and yours as well, Nolan, but from my perspective, I think that's the like most like obvious thing that happens is it's all about me and not about how can I actually help and add value to the other side.
Yeah, I totally agree. And the expectation management, particularly as it relates to integration, I mean, I personally think that people don't think through implementation far enough. We get so excited to make the deal and we're so excited about the possibility that we don't go the final step, which is, and what does this look like in implementation? How do we hold ourselves accountable? What happens when it doesn't achieve, we don't achieve the benchmarks that we were hoping to? How do we come back and have those conversations and correct? To me, those are the things that become problematic and we could have addressed them during the negotiation, but we didn't.
Yeah. And then I think the two things that come to mind for me is whenever we're thinking about the other person at the table is when we have opportunities to expand the pie. And so instead of just thinking about how am I going to get the most out of this deal? How are we going to sweeten this deal for both of us? And then the second part of that is how are we going to make this a deal that we can defend to our toughest critics, right? So as soon as we walk away from that table, you got to think about all the other stakeholders who are not presently there, but are going to be involved in the deal. So
yeah, great point, Nolan.
Talking a little bit more about kind of boardroom negotiations, Guy, do the dynamics of how you approach an internal conversation, negotiation, discussion with, again, internal key stakeholders, does it change when you're dealing with an executive who's incredibly senior or maybe just an expert in their domain versus when you're dealing maybe with, I don't know, lower level internal folks or even external stakeholders?
Yeah, absolutely. It definitely does change. So it doesn't matter who you talk to, right? They love talking about themselves or what they think they know. Right. And I'm making a generalization, but that's really like a good generalization, right? Is people love talking about themselves and or just love talking, right? So when I'm in that situation, right, and kind of like managing up, for want of a better term,
yeah,
if I'm the one talking, I know there's something wrong, right? That's not wrong, but that's when I know the other person is a good negotiator or influencer, right? So if they're asking me the probing questions, business or personal, Guy, how are the kids? Did you ride this past weekend? How's it going with your move to Boca? You know, all these questions. I know that that if they're interested and with authenticity showing interest in me, right, and they want to learn more about me, they know what they're doing, right? So it's not a mistake that they're in their position, right, as an executive or senior executive in a company. If they're asking me the questions and I'm the one talking, I need to, like, I quite quickly try to catch myself on that and pause and try to turn the table, right, and essentially let them talk. And if they don't, ask them questions, but try to turn the table where you're showing the interest. And even if they are an expert in influencing or they have that skill, right, and they're good at it, you can still change it.
Thanks for your perspective, Guy, on that. Kind of sticking with this theme of the boardroom, have you ever had to deal with a senior executive who refuses to hear you out or rejects your suggestions? And if so, can you share the example and what worked when influencing upward?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's happened so many times, right? You very, very often get pushed back, and at all stages of your career, right? It's not necessarily when you're young or in middle management or any of the different cases, but all of these interactions are built on a foundation of trust and respect, right? So I've had it so many times, right? I actually came up with a term, right? I don't think I came up with it, but I learned this, right? And it's creating a circle of influence. So let's say that I want to go to the board and I want to convince them to do a special project, right? That I think would like move the needle. I never go in alone, right? So I try bring on a few board members that I know are kind and caring and open to listening and have an open mind and all of those good things. And I try get a one-on-one with them. And then when I've had a one-on-one with them and I feel like I've won them over, I try get other people on my side, let's call it, right? And creating that circle of influence is really, really important, because if I just go in and I say, hey guys, this is my idea, like I think we should do this, and you'll notice that I used I and my, right? Compared to if I had to go in and say, we've discussed this at length, we think this is a great idea, what do you all think about it? Right. And then my circle of influence says, we think that's a great idea as well. And we've discussed it and, you know, we've thought about this and we've thought about that. And then you've got a whole team kind of like negotiating for you. Right. And you're just and you're not taking credit for anything. And I think that's the key point. Right. Is you create the circle of influence. You understand their needs. Right. And you and focus on active listening for what they're trying to achieve, because they just want to add value. Board members are there because, you know, they want to add value. They want to be a key person on the team, and they have a fiduciary duty, right? So understanding their needs and active listening is really important. Then creating that circle of influence. And then beyond that, with the executives, you need to choose the right moment, right? So you can't just go to them at like some random point in time, right? They need to be expecting this, right? Yeah. And that's why like board meetings are really good, because they have agendas and they're very good at having agendas. Right. So putting something on the agenda is something that everyone can expect and wait for and prepare for, right? And even getting out materials beforehand helps. So communicating clearly and concisely and in a timely manner is really important. And then having evidence, right? Like evidence-based arguments, instead of just arriving and just kind of like taking a flyer, right? And saying, hey, I think we should do this, right? That's like the totally wrong way to do it, right? So create your evidence, have your circle of influence, and then be open to feedback and being able to adapt, right? What you go in with is not going to be your final product, right? Mm. And it might get shut down completely for reasons you haven't even thought about. But being open to feedback and adapting is key. And then having, again, like we discussed earlier, is persistence and patience, right? Those are really, really key. And then beyond that, having empathy and the strategic communication, and then resilience, right? Because being shut down doesn't mean you did anything wrong or that your idea was terrible. So you have to be resilient. And you also have to be empathetic, because very often executives are under huge amounts of stress, right? They're under pressure. They want to do the best that they can do. And you need to put yourself in their shoes. So I hope that's helpful and that answers your question. But
I would say incredibly helpful. To build, just go one step further here on a couple of those points when you talked about timing and sharing data. A question I commonly get is, hey, how much do I give a senior exec as a read ahead? And I guess for a couple of thoughts there, and I know it's not a perfect answer, but I'm curious to get your take, is I want to give them enough to kind of let them know the direction we're going. And at the same time, if they dig too far into it, then it might unravel the whole purpose of the meetings. So do you have any sense and gut feeling? I know it probably changes from context and situation, but you know, how much read ahead do you provide in terms of here's what I have, here's what this is going to be about? What do you do from that perspective?
Aram, I think that's a really, really great and key question, right? So going back to our discussion earlier on patience and the years that you build trust, right? And it takes you to actually get to a negotiation point. That's no different in this scenario, right? So you don't just arrive at the board meeting or a week before the board meeting, just randomly send out like an email to the executive team and say, to be discussed at board meeting as the subject, right? And just attach materials regardless of length, right? This should be something that you've built trust in them already, or you've planted the seed, you've updated them on your progress. This is something that they know exists and they know that you're working on, and you're building that relationship with them and trust in this product or special project or whatever that you're working on, right? So going into that board meeting, right, or sending out the materials beforehand is the time zero. But as we've discussed, it starts at time minus five. So yeah, it's the same thing, right? Is that you, the first time I bring these things up is in like a end of a meeting. And usually it's with just one person in the circle of influence, just as like a teaser. What do they think? They love it. Fantastic. Let me just bring it up in a teaser format with another board member or another person on my circle of influence, right? And when I felt that these four, five, six people have loved the idea and think it's great and willing to work with me and they're part of the circle of influence, then I just continuously build out that circle of influence to a point where I mention it to the executive. And then just grow it from there, right? So it's not a, you know, what I send like the week before and then put it on the agenda. This is something that is like everyone's aware of it and it's built up over time and it's not a shock to the system or a surprise for anyone.
Organizations are spending a lot of money, billions of dollars each year on leadership development training. And that includes negotiation and influence skills. And unfortunately, without organizational commitment and discipline towards ensuring personnel policies, company strategy, operational procedures align with that training, the value of paying for this developmental training, just it's never realized. In your experience, Guy, what do you see the very best, the top tier, the top 10% of companies do to raise the bar around these sorts of skills, negotiation skills, influence skills for everyone within their organization beyond training?
Love the question, Aram. So essentially, the old school way of doing things is dead, right? Like forcing people's hands and things like that just doesn't work, right? And all the research, you know, backs that up. So essentially having non-mandatory training, but having a training stipend, right, and a training library for people to tap into at will is really important. And I've seen it work very often, right? Like a book club, right? Or a book library, a company book library, where like you get a stipend and you can get as many books as you want, as long as they're on the company library, right? And just letting people choose. And I use this term a lot, and my M&A team and investment team, everyone knows me for this term, and it's people hate being sold to, but people love buying things. And that mindset is key in training as well, right, for employees. So again, you need a willing buyer, right, and a willing seller, right? And your willing buyer in this case is the employee, right, or even the executive, right, to be willingly trained. And again, another like really key point here is the KISS principle, keep it simple, right? So related to the work that they're doing now, right? Actually help them with what the challenges they're facing now and make it practical. And then beyond that, be there for them afterwards, right? So bring the authors in for question days and, you know, all that type of stuff, where after reading the book, you can actually like ask questions and ask for practical tips and relate it to the work you're working on now.
Yeah. I appreciate what you're saying. There's intentionality required to make those things happen. The you know, kind of the book resources, the relating to the current challenges they're in, the being there afterwards. I mean, to me, that speaks to being a learning organization, reviewing what we've learned, tying in KPIs to your performance and making sure there's alignment between what am I really rewarding you for and the way in which you went and negotiated the deal. All these things are important considerations, And if we're not thinking and talking about them, they don't just magically happen.
Totally, totally. They're all intentional, right? And if employees want to better themselves and you have the correct training available, they will tap into it, right? It's just about creating that intention and keeping it simple and giving them access to it where it's easy.
Guy, you obviously live a very demanding life between your career and personal life. Have you found success in negotiating at home? And if so, you've got to tell me, because I don't think that this is an area that I've mastered. Not sure about Aram, but I know I haven't. So
you're not sure? Yeah. I think we spent enough time together. You know, I haven't either. And if not, we can line the kids up and they can talk about my lack of mastery. So yeah, Guy, we're open ears here.
Aram, I think we got to learn from you, right? But yeah, like I'm learning every day, right? I think that's the key. As long as you're moving forward, you're in the right direction. But it's one thing negotiating with a partner, right? But I think young children without like a fully developed prefrontal cortex, they take this challenge to a whole new level, right? So, you know, I think the principles remain the same, right? With kids and adults and patience, which we spoke about earlier, care. One thing I find works really well with my daughter is I drop to her eye level, right? So I get down on one knee and I hold her hands in my hands or I hold her face. Sometimes she doesn't allow me to hold her face, but I hold her hands in my hands or I hold her face. And I feel that makes her feel like secure and safe, right? And whenever she sees me drop down on one knee and put my hands out, like she runs to me, right? So for her, it's like a safe space. And then when I'm in that position, you know, I ask myself, what are her needs and wants right now, right? You've got to use that empathy, right? I find myself doing this a lot, right? Going back and saying, I don't really remember when I was three, but I kind of have that inner child inside of me. So how do I tap into that inner child, right? And try to put myself in her shoes and listen actively again, right? And again, one thing we haven't really touched on is multiple offers, right? And a package focus. And one of the key things I've learned and has helped me extensively as a parent is the this or that technique, which is multiple offers, right? Basically saying, okay, do you want this dress or that dress? Do you want to brush your teeth or do you want me to brush your teeth? You know, like these things, you know, do you want carrots or cucumbers? You know, this or that technique has really been like an amazing technique that I use every day, multiple times a day, because if you just say, do you want a carrot? No, I don't want a carrot. Do you want the pink dress? No, I don't want the pink dress, right? So again, it's like, how do you just get to an agreement, right? And this or that puts power back in her hands And especially if I drop down on one knee and hold her hands, it just makes it easier.
Lovely, right? I mean, the power of choice and the getting to their perspective. Got to tell a quick story here, guy, you can probably relate to. When we were living in Colorado, we had a little raspberry area and we had a storm coming in. Raspberries were ripe. My oldest son was out with me. And at the time, I don't know, three or four, like on the age you're talking about with your daughter. And I said, hey, we got to pick these berries quickly. And I was focused on time and efficiency, get these things picked. And so he's not keeping up with me as we're going through the little berry patch to pick up. And I said, come on, Ransom, hurry up. And he said, Dad, you're missing some. And I don't miss picking raspberries. I mean, I get them all. I know how good I am, right? And so at first, I didn't respond with the kind of the empathy and care that you're describing. I was more focused on, you know, I didn't miss anything. Hurry up. You're lagging behind. It was when I stopped and I got down on a knee, as you're describing, and I looked at what he was talking about. He was absolutely correct. There were raspberries underneath the leaves. I couldn't see. They were down at his level. He was absolutely right. It took me, though, taking his perspective to see that. And anyways, it was a lasting point for me that I'm going to always miss things when I'm only looking at the problem from through my lens.
Absolutely. Love that story. Thank you, Aaron. Yeah, totally.
Well, listen, this has been a fantastic conversation. A lot of fun. I know we've covered a lot of ground. I can imagine that we've only scratched the surface of the things that you think about and write about, Guy. You know, as kind of a final maybe thing to leave with listeners, what didn't Nolan and I ask you that, you know, you'd like to maybe share either as a final thought or perhaps a challenge for folks who really want to get better as negotiators?
So I appreciate that, Aaron. And it's really been a pleasure speaking with you both and happy to jump on another chat any time to discuss more. But yeah, I think if I had to leave like with one thought and one challenge for all the listeners, a thought would be, when's the last time you entered a negotiation thinking about helping the other side accomplish their most pressing needs? Right? So think about that, right? Like when's the last time, and maybe not for you two, but for the listeners. And in terms of a challenge, I just say try listen more, but not just listen. Listen actively, right? Be conscious of who is talking, who is asking the questions, what are they actually saying, and then just see what happens to your relationships in your personal and business life when you ask and actively listen more. And I hope that's helpful. And I'd love anyone to contact me or you guys and let me know how that helps them or doesn't.
Absolutely.
Really appreciate that. And we'll make sure that our listeners know how to get in touch with you and can reach out to you for follow-up. Guy, thanks so much for spending the time with us today.
Thank you both so much. Thank you, Nolan. Thank you, Aaron. I really appreciate the invite and it's really been a pleasure speaking with you both.
So that is it for us on today's podcast. If you haven't already, please rate, review, and subscribe to NegotiateX Podcast and we'll see you in the next episode.
Thank you for listening to NegotiateX Radio, helping you elevate your influence through purposeful negotiations. If you're here looking to learn about how to become a better negotiator in both business and life, then you're in the right place. Be sure to join the others who have benefited from NegotiateX.com, your home for negotiations training and consulting online.